Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America and worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned with us for tonight's report on circumcision right after this message. Well, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime, what should you say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself and your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure. And rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything and shut up. After rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, it's informative. But best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for home, school, and if you're online. You can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, in the last two episodes, we discovered that the Medical Association is all over the map as to their belief and their practice concerning circumcision. Looking at it from 1860 through the present, we find that circumcision has gone from 0.001% to 90%, now back down to 60% of the male children born in America being circumcised. And the medical practice and profession from 1860 to the present time has had every belief that you can imagine. And I went through probably 30 or 40 of those beliefs. We thought that it caused, that the lack of circumcision caused all kinds of diseases, and that circumcision would miraculously cure them or certainly was a treatment for them. Finally, in 1971, the pediatric people, that is the pediatricians, came to the conclusion that there was no medical reason for circumcision. And now the question arises, is there a medical reason for circumcision or not? Let me ask that question, and in today's program, let's answer it with right up to the minute, last week, last month, or last year's medical information, the latest that we can get our hands on. Let's see what's going on in the medical world concerning circumcision. Here's a story called Circumventing Cancer with Circumspect Circumcision. It goes like this, written by a doctor, by the way, and it's here's the story. It says, 42-year-old Jack Schmidt shifted his weight nervously on the examining room table as I washed my hands. Well, what brings you here, I asked. I had noticed that he had not come to see me in over 5 years. Well, Doc, I've got this lump that I guess you should take a look at. It's probably nothing, but I've been getting kind of worried about it. And Jack proceeded to show me a golf ball-sized tumor that looked something like a small head of cauliflower with a large cratered ulcer in the middle. How long have you had this, I asked. Oh, for several weeks, at least. Well, how about 6 months to a year, I asked, and Jack looked startled. Yeah, I guess, how did you know, Doc? Well, the next day, we admitted Jack to the hospital, and as I had guessed, the pathologist diagnosed the surgical sample of his tumor to be squamous cell carcinoma of the penis, with metastases to the lymph nodes of the groin. When I broke the news to Jack, he covered his face with his hands, and he sobbed, why me? Why me? Why Jack? Well, first of all, he had waited too long to get any help from the surgeon's knife. If he had seen me 6 months or a year earlier while the cancer was still localized, his treatment would have resulted almost certainly in a cure. It was, or typically is, surgically curable. But at this late stage, we could offer him very little hope. Studies have shown that over 1/3 of the victims of this cancer put off seeking treatment until their cancer has reached an incurable state. And despite radical surgery, removal of the penis, and the lymph nodes of the groin, Jack died about 2 years later, leaving behind 2 boys and a mother. Now, what makes Jack's death even more tragic is the fact that medical science has now proved that cancer of the penis is almost entirely preventable by following a simple instruction that God gave to Abraham over 4,000 years ago. The history of this recognition is intriguing. In 1932, Dr. A. L. Wolbarst of New York reviewed the records of 1,103 cases of cancer of the penis. Among all of these cases, there was not one Jew. Indeed, cancer of the penis is so astoundingly rare among Jews that its very occurrence warrants publication in a medical journal. Since Dr. Wolbarst's study, only 6 cases of such cancers in Jews have been reported between 1932 and the present time. Now, why are Jewish men almost entirely free of this lethal cancer? Well, medical researchers have found that this spectacular freedom results from the practice of circumcision instituted by God over 4,000 years ago. Jewish men are not the only men immune to this disease. Researchers have found that any man circumcised in infancy will also enjoy this immunity. In 3 large studies covering 521 cases of cancer of the penis, not a single circumcised man was found. What makes this statistic even more startling is the finding that in the age group at risk for this cancer, about 1/2 of men were circumcised. Thus, one would have expected about 260 cases, half of the 521, to occur in men who had been circumcised. Instead, they found none. Now, from India comes another convincing study. In India, there are 4 major religious groups. They are Hindus, Christians, Parsis, and Muslims. Muslims circumcise their sons between the ages of 3 and 12, but none of the other groups practice circumcision. Among the Hindus, Christians, and Parsi men, cancers of the penis make up 330 of every 10,000 cancers. But among circumcised Muslims, only 15 out of 10,000 cancers are diagnosed as cancer of the penis. The cause for most of these 15 cancers is probably the Muslim practice of delaying circumcision until a boy is several years old. Although cancer of the penis is fairly rare in the United States, the actual rate of this cancer in uncircumcised men is about 1 in 600. Thus, if none of the 1.8 million American boys born each year were circumcised, we would expect about 3,000 of these boys to have penile cancer during their lifetimes and about 1,000 to die from this disease. Now, how does circumcision protect men from penile cancer? Well, most experts feel that these cancers are caused by smegma. Smegma, a filthy and foul-smelling paste of bacteria and dead cells that are trapped under the foreskin. By circumcision, that is, around cutting, the foreskin is removed, eliminating the small pouch on the end of the penis where smegma accumulates. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics states that circumcision, properly performed, eliminates much of the need for careful penile hygiene. If circumcision is not elected, however, then the necessity for lifelong penile hygiene should be discussed with parents. Routine retraction of the foreskin and careful cleansing of the penile head would cleanse the penis of smegma and theoretically eliminate the risk of penile cancer. Thus, the American Academy of Pediatrics holds that there is no valid medical indications for circumcision in the neonatal period. This recommendation, however, is based on the erroneous assumption that if you tell a boy to wash something, he will do it. Most mothers have had the exasperating experience of repeatedly sending a son to the bathroom to wash behind his ears. In fact, one study found that only 1 out of 4 uncircumcised teenage boys who had a retractable foreskin actually practiced personal penile hygiene. Now, in recent years, a tremendous amount of debate about the pros and cons of circumcision has appeared in medical journals. Articles entitled Penile Plunder and the Rape of the Phallus underscore the emotional opposition of some physicians to circumcision. Others have pointed to the origins of the anti-circumcision movement as growing out of guilt-induced anxiety, leading to a fear of genital injury, and they further state that the catalytic element for the anti-circumcision swell lies in the current aura of protest. Movements abound to save wild horses, or to save the polar bears, or to save the islands and the lakes. The establishment is seen as a universal bad guy. In this atmosphere, the male infant is easily and emotionally envisioned as helpless and unmarred, as indeed he is. The literature of the anti-circumcision crusade has recently received the edition of a book by Edward Wallerstein. Although Mr. Wallerstein refers to over 450 different authors, he fails to quote any of the statistics that I have just mentioned regarding penile carcinoma. But instead, he reasons, the argument that carcinoma of the penis will be prevented by circumcision is hardly valid, for there are cases of this disease in circumcised males. However, it is his reasoning that is invalid. Medical literature finds penile carcinoma to be extremely rare, but not non-existent in circumcised males. His statement is analogous to saying, quote, since men may die, however rarely, from breast cancer, men are not protected from breast cancer. Or, since non-smokers may die, however rarely, from lung cancer, they are not protected from this cancer. The fact is that even in the United States, uncircumcised men have well over a hundredfold greater risk of penile carcinoma. That is, uncircumcised men have well over a 100 times greater risk of penile cancer than those that are circumcised. Now, some doctors who recognize that circumcision prevents penile cancer point out that circumcision is surgery, so it involves a certain amount of risk. And the largest study to date of the risk of circumcision found in 500,000 newborn circumcisions only one death, which occurred after a ritual circumcision in a home that was complicated by a delay in obtaining a transfusion. Now, if these 500,000 newborns had not been circumcised, we would expect statistically about 830 would come down with penile carcinoma, and that about 275 would then, as a result, die from this disease. So the statistics speak for themselves. You can have one death from circumcision or 275 from cancer. Now, if we have these statistics in the United States, where most people practice daily bathing of their bodies, can you imagine the problem in more primitive cultures where washing the body, let alone the head of the penis, is an extremely rare event and where penile cancer is invariably fatal? Now, while I worked in Africa, I was appalled at the high prevalence of lethal penile cancer among the uncircumcised nationals. In fact, penile cancer makes up 18% of the male cancers in China, a land of poor hygiene and uncircumcised males. Now, to such a people, the nomadic household of Abraham, God gave the commandment to circumcise every male. Even the most adamant opponents of circumcision recognize that this procedure is necessary for many boys who cannot retract their foreskin at all. Circumcision facilitates cleanliness by eliminating the need for scrupulous penile hygiene. Now, in Canada, where only 50% of newborns are circumcised, over 10,000 therapeutic circumcisions are performed on boys who have passed infancy. For these surgeries, the boys are put to sleep under general anesthesia, which carries with it a risk of death of about 1 in 10,000. So, one would expect about one Canadian boy per year to die from therapeutic circumcision. However, if all of the 90,000 uncircumcised boys had been circumcised as infants, an average of over 5 years would have passed between deaths from these circumcisions. Serious risk remains even if the doctor performs the surgery by numbing the area with a local anesthetic. Recently, two doctors reported two young men who became permanently impotent following circumcision with a local anesthetic. And also, these circumcisions done on older boys and men are much more expensive than infant circumcisions due to the additional hospital stay, doctor's cost, and their work loss. Now, one author has estimated that if all Canadian boys were circumcised as infants, it would result in a savings of over $18 million per year. Thus, we see the routine infant circumcision is cost-effective and prevents death from penile cancer and delayed surgery. Now, after many laborious years of study, medical science has demonstrated the most effective way of preventing the deadly squamous cell carcinoma of the penis. Science did not arrive at this conclusion because of any laboratory steam that it had generated on its own. Rather, it was carried forward by a long train of statistics that existed only because of the many generations of Jews and Muslims that had faithfully followed the command that God gave their father Abraham. And in the first edition of this book, I cited the evidence that cancer of the uterine, cervix, the tip of the uterus that caps off the vagina, was primarily a disease of sexual partners of uncircumcised males. In the intervening years, however, cervical cancer has been more firmly related to multiple sexual partners. And one study of the death certificates of 13,000 celibate nuns did not turn up even a single cancer of the cervix. And a recent study found evidence of venereal warts or venereal wart viruses in 73 out of every 80 women who had cervical cancer. Thus, it seems that cervical cancer is, for the most part, a result of the venereal disease, and therefore, following biblical moral principles would probably wipe out this common cancer. So as we can see here, cancer then of the penis is rare. It's 18% of cancer cases in China. It's unheard of among male Jews who are circumcised. What does this tell us so far? And I'm reading now from a book written by a medical doctor. I think this guy's a Seventh-day Adventist, as I recall. He's in favor of circumcision, and he's in favor of infant circumcision, and he pointed out that among Muslims who don't practice infant circumcision, or at least not as a general rule, that by circumcising children between the ages of 3 and 12 gives them an added risk of penile cancer that's not associated with the Jewish population. Now, I want to point out one more thing, and that is during the Black Plague in the Middle Ages, Jews were virtually unaffected by the bubonic plague. So naturally, the Christians around them blamed the Jews for poisoning their water. There was something wrong with these Jews because they didn't get sick and die like the rest of us. And it didn't occur to people, and it still doesn't to this day, that Jews don't eat pork, fat, blood, and shellfish. Now, as a result of that, they have healthier immune systems and stronger, healthier bodies. Now, while the Christians were dying like flies from the Black Death, the Jews didn't. And so the Christians, being good Christians that they were, went out and started persecuting and killing the Jews, because if they weren't going to die from bubonic plague, then we need to kill them with the sword. Well, what are we going to do today? Since the rest of us, that is those that are not circumcised, come down with penile cancer and the Jews don't, shouldn't we go out and kill as many Jews as we can because they must be causing our penile cancer? I mean, that's the kind of logic that you see running around in the halls of Congress and in the medical association. I read to you the last time about the medical practices from 1860 to 1994. And did you notice that in the reports from 1971 through 2000, up to the present time, that they said there is no medical evidence that circumcision has any medical value? Now, we haven't gotten into the old covenant contract with Abraham yet, but I'm gonna give you a little advanced billing. I'll give you an advanced preview because I read the contract. And remember that, you know, if we're going to practice law, that's why we call this the law hour. If we're going to look at the law, we have to look at the contract. There's nothing in the contract that says there's any medical benefits at all. The purpose for circumcision has nothing to do with medicine, has nothing to do with health. It is not a health statute, and it's not a health law, although there is a health benefit that comes from it. It's almost like you're entitled to 70 years, 25,550 days of life, trouble-free, no disease, if you practice this law. That is the 18 health law. But there isn't anything in the contract that tells us that this law, circumcision, has anything to do with health, and indeed God doesn't even tell you that it's for health purposes. Health benefits come from it. That's being demonstrated here. We can see from the statistics. Now, I'm not telling you to go get circumcised, but, you know, you figure it out for yourself. Your chances of getting penile cancer aren't very great anyway, at least not in America. It's pretty great, 18% in China. It's probably 18% in India, everywhere where people live below the poverty line and are dirty. Don't keep clean. But here in America, even if you're below poverty, you probably have a bathroom, you probably have a bathtub, you probably are cleaner than the average Chinaman or the average Indian. And therefore, you're going to be cleaner and you'll probably have less of this smut, whatever it was, smetta. And as a result of that, your chances of getting penile cancer aren't very good. But your chances of getting penile cancer if you're circumcised, especially if it's infant circumcision, is zero. The Jews don't have any cases. Well, there was 4 cases reported in America between 32 and 2000. Let's see, how many years is that? 70 years. So in 70 years, we've had 4 cases among Jews. Now, that ought to tell you a little story, shouldn't it? All right, let's go on. One night while I was in Africa, the chief of the local tribe awakened me, and he asked me to perform a circumcision on his 12-year-old son. So I did the procedure in the operating room, and the chief requested that I tell no one about the clandestine surgery. And for my payment, he invited me to attend the ritual circumcision for the rest of the 12-year-old boys in the tribe. 2 weeks later, I arrived at the site for the ritual. For several hours, the 12-year-olds threw eerie shadows as they danced around a large bonfire. Then they lined up against a fence with a large butcher knife in hand. The witch doctor, his body painted in orange and red, and his face covered with a grotesque wooden mask, approached the trembling boys. Suddenly, he grasped the foreskin of the first boy in line, leaped 3 feet into the air, shrieked a cry of terrifying vengeance, and severed the foreskin from the unsuspecting boy, and he repeated this procedure on the rest of the boys. With the chief's son, he then entered a small hut, where he repeated the sound effects, but not the procedure. And while all of the other boys were moaning in excruciating pain, the chief's son exited the hut defiantly. He jumped on a donkey, and he rode into the village, whereupon all of the members of the tribe recognized the superior character of the heir to the throne. What about pain? Well, no one should deny that circumcision is a painful experience. But the amount of pain suffered is related to the age of the male being circumcised. Now, the most careful study of this matter was conducted by Dr. Joseph Katz. In infants up to 3 weeks old, he observed pain and irritability only at the immediate time of the surgery. See that? The immediate time of the surgery. However, infants from 4 weeks to 3 months old were still irritable during the night following surgery. Children between 3 months to 1 year were irritable for 3 or 4 days. Adults suffered pain and discomfort for at least a week. Moreover, circumcisions done on older boys or adults also carry the psychological trauma of removing a private part of their bodies. For example, one study found that boys circumcised between the ages of 4 and 7 viewed the operation as an attack on their bodies, and this procedure resulted in an increase in their aggressive emotions even several days after surgery. Even thinking about the procedure produces discomfort in most men. Well, I'll drink to that. Yeah, I don't relish that. I told you I talked to 3 or 4 men that I have had contact with over the years, over my lifetime, and they all reported to me that it was 2 weeks, 2 weeks that they suffered pain. Now, let's go back here to infant circumcision. If you'll go back to the law, which we'll cover a little later on, probably on last part of this program, last part of this story, is that Abraham was circumcised as an old man, 99 years old. But he circumcised his son Isaac, who was 8 days old, and the law requires it to be done on the 8th day, which just happens to coincide with the highest level of vitamin K, or the blood clotting agent. Did it ever occur to any of us that the pain associated with circumcision on the 8th day is nigh on to non-existent, or very minimal? I mean, if your vitamin K is at the highest level on the 8th day, did it ever occur to any of us that maybe God had provided for the pain factor the same way he did for the blood clotting factor? Now, I reported to you that I don't suffer from aggressiveness, but I think that if I had been circumcised at about age 16, I might be displaying some aggressiveness, and I might be just downright bummed out over the thought or the process, especially if it had been done to me because of some punishment that somebody had dreamed up, punishment like the medical profession came up with for masturbation. Hey, listen, we got to pay the rent. Let me take a moment here and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. It's sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. You know, when I'm asked who I would recommend for a lawyer, I recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Yeah, that's right, Jerry Spence. But if you can't afford Jerry Spence, my second choice would be you. That's right. And that's because you're the best person to represent your interests in court. After all, you were there, you did it, or you didn't do it, you know who else was there, you know what was said, you know who said it, you know who was lying, and you know who was telling the truth. You know. But your lawyer doesn't know any more than you can tell him, and besides that, nobody likes a lawyer anyway. Now, the abhorrence of the legal profession is documented throughout Anglo-Saxon history. Remember Shakespeare's Dick the Butcher and King Henry VI exclaimed, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." Charles Dickens wrote that if there were no bad people, there would be no good lawyers. Poor Richard in his almanac said, "God works wonders now and then. Behold, a lawyer, an honest man." So scorned were lawyers by the colonists that they were depicted as lawyer birds with their long bills and lawyer fish, always slippery. And both Massachusetts and Rhode Island prohibited lawyers from serving in their colonial assemblies. Well, representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment and 3 rules, and that is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, Why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for home education. And if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the medical literature. We're trying to figure out if there's any medical reasons for circumcision. Now, I showed you a little earlier that the medical reasons for circumcision were non-existent according to the reports that we got post-1971. But I don't think they gave us all of the statistics. They didn't, any of them that I cited from the medical literature, cite any of these studies. Nobody ever mentioned the Jews who have been practicing the circumcision for about 4,000 years. Funny, you know, how the medical people, they jump on the bandwagon and tell you it cures everything from warts and the heartbreak of psoriasis to epilepsy, and then they change course and tell you there's no medical reasons for using it, and then they don't cite any of the studies that have been done that prove that it does, in fact, prevent. It doesn't cure the disease after it occurs, but it prevents it. Why does it prevent it? Because you're cleaner. And when it's done in infancy rather than later in life, it eliminates complications. The hostility that you saw mentioned in here, you know, and the problems that these people, the pain and the suffering, you know, nobody has ever interviewed an eight-day-old baby to find out, well, gee, on a scale of one to ten, partner, how did that hurt? We are imagining the great pain associated. Now, when the pain studies were actually reported, I just reported to you that the eight-day-old baby doesn't seem to have very much discomfort, which would indicate to me that the high level of vitamin K is probably also responsible for the very little pain involved. It probably is the equivalent of an anesthetic. Ah, nobody has come up with that study. Nobody has come up with, until we read this report. Wonder why they didn't want to tell us that. You know, I always get suspicious of people, especially paid professionals, that don't give me all the facts. Now, they didn't lie to us. They deceived us. The modern medical man is deceptive, but he didn't lie. He didn't tell us that there were no medical advantages to it. Did he? Well, he most assuredly did, and it came right out of the most prestigious medical group in the country, and it deals with children. That's the pediatricians, and the pediatricians are the one that says that there's no benefit to it, and then they didn't give us the studies that show the benefits for it. Now I've read to you the benefits that come from it, and they totally ignore the Jews. It's dishonest if it isn't an out-and-out lie. It's certainly dishonest, and I'd go so far as to say, as Mark Twain would put it, there's liars, damn liars, and there's statistics. Well, if they're not damn liars, they're at least liars. In the last program, I read to you their statements in more modern times that there's no benefits at all. That's a lie. There are benefits, although that's not the intended purpose for circumcision. We'll get to that later. At birth, the baby's intestines contain no bacteria. And between the fifth and the seventh day of life, these bacteria begin to proliferate and produce the important vitamin, vitamin K. This vitamin goes to the liver, where it plays an important part in forming four different clotting proteins. Now, if any one of these proteins is missing, serious bleeding may result. Now, in most normal babies, blood levels of all four proteins decrease quickly after birth because infants are vitamin K deficient. Today, however, doctors boost the infant's clotting system by giving newborn babies shots of vitamin K. Thus, medical science has eliminated this potentially serious bleeding disorder. But did you notice that, I had this happen to me. My oldest boy, Ted, when he was born, the doctor said, well, we want to circumcise him. Well, he asked me if they wanted, and I said, yes, we do. And he said, well, we're going to do it right now. And I said, no, not until the eighth day. And he said, well, why do you want to wait? And I said, I don't know why I want to wait. It's what the law requires. That's what Moses wrote, and so that's what we're going to do. And he started arguing with me, and he jumped up and down, pawed the ground, bit the bushes. I imagine most people cave in and say, well, okay, Doc, I'm sure that you want to go play golf, you know, on that next Wednesday. So, okay, well, you go ahead and do it. I told him, hell no. And if you don't want to do it on the eighth day, I'll change my insurance plan. It got done on the eighth day, and then the other two I didn't have a problem with. But that first one there, they tried to intimidate me into doing it. I didn't know anything about this vitamin K thing. Now, surely, if this doctor knows about that vitamin K thing, and there's research been done, I mean, listen to the study here. The vitamin goes to the liver. How in the hell does anybody know that these four proteins go to the liver and create a vitamin called vitamin K, which you can synthesize and then give this baby a shot of vitamin K? Every doctor in America knows this story about the vitamin K and the eighth day. And if they don't, then they have to be suffering from the terminal stupids. Now, I didn't know it when I was age 23. I was young and dumb. I know it now. And I can't believe that doctors going to medical school reading textbooks don't know the same story. It's just that they don't want to wait till the eighth day. After all, they all believe in the theory of evolution, and God's a liar, and the 6 days of creation is a myth, and you evolve from green algae. And we, you know, if you evolve from green algae, how come the vitamin K doesn't appear in some people on the first day and in some people at age two or three or some other? I mean, it's uniform in all races and everybody, whether they're Chinese or Mongolian or they're Americans or Africans or whatever. It's the eighth day. Now, that sends me a signal. That says to me that somebody thought this out. Thought it out before anybody came up with the idea of circumcision. If the creation was, in fact, completed on the sixth day. Now he goes on to say, one of the proteins dependent on vitamin K is known as prothrombin. The following graph, based on data collected before the era of routine vitamin K shots. And the fact that these doctors give these routine vitamin K shots when they do the circumcision before the eighth day, or even if they do it after that, tells you plainly that they know about this vitamin K and the eighth day story. Shows that by the third day of the baby's life, the available prothrombin is only 30% of normal. By the eighth day, however, we see that the available prothrombin skyrockets to 110% of the adult level. It soon levels off to a normal 100%. So an average eight-day-old baby has more available prothrombin, not quite getting that right, it's prothrombin, than on any other day of his life. Thus, the safest day in a male's entire life to perform a circumcision is on the eighth day. Now, we should also commend the many hundreds of workers who labored at great expense over a number of years and found that the safest day to perform circumcision is the eighth. Yet, as we congratulate medical science, we almost hear the pages of the Bible rustling when we turn to Genesis 17:12 and read God's words to Abraham. Remember, he said to Abraham, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. 8 days. So Abraham did not pick the eighth day after many centuries of trial and error experiments and double-blind tests and studies, although many modern physicians think otherwise. For example, we read in a 1982 edition of the Cecil Textbook of Medicine, the vitamin K deficient state lasts for 3 to 5 days and may be the reason why the Israelites did not circumcise their babies until the eighth day. However, in babies who are not given vitamin K shots, only 1 in 200 to 400 babies suffers a bleeding disorder. Thus, in order to determine that the eighth day was the safest day to circumcise, the Hebrews, remember, a primitive, nomadic, desert-dwelling people, would have had to conduct immense, carefully designed experiments, including thousands of circumcisions performed on each day of the newborn's life. Why not accept the Bible statement that God spoke to Abraham and said, this is the law? Well, neither Abraham nor any of his company from the ancient city of Ur in the Chaldees had ever been circumcised. And although some of the Middle Eastern peoples did practice circumcision, historians feel that infant circumcision was unique to the Israelites. Thus, the eighth day was not picked by some genius in statistical analysis, but by the Creator himself, the guy that created vitamin K. Now, although it is often thought that Jewish circumcision was instituted for health reasons, there is no evidence to support this view. Moses Maimonides, the famous 12th century Jewish physician, stated that no one, however, should circumcise himself or his son for any other reason but pure faith. This is also the position of modern Orthodox rabbis such as Eric Isaac. The Orthodox Jewish community is intent on affirming the strictly religious character of circumcision and thus on eliminating the medical aura surrounding the practice. Even a modern-day physician, Dr. Joseph Miller, has written, many people today believe that circumcision is primarily a health measure. This is not the fact. Circumcision is the symbol of the covenant between God and the Jewish nation. Well, that's his opinion, but here's the moral to the story. This medical doctor here says he can't see any medical reason for doing it. The Bible doesn't tell us of any medical reason, and prominent Jewish rabbis have not claimed that there's some medical reason for doing this. It has to do with this covenant with Abraham. We'll take a look at that contract as we progress along. My point here is that there is medical benefits that come from it. It's not the reason. It's just that there's a side benefit. Circumcision on the eighth day has a benefit. There's less bleeding and probably less pain. The vitamin K on the eighth day probably acts as an anesthetic. And so all of the hand-wringing by all of these preachers and lawyers and all of these activists out here, oh my God, this barbaric mayhem that's being committed on these children, isn't being committed at all. What they're in effect saying is that God is a heinous animal, some kind of a brute, who instructs his followers to molest baby boys, to commit mayhem and assault, mutilation. That's the effect of what they're telling them. I'm not so sure that that's the case, although we haven't got to that yet. Using these and other quotes, Mr. Edward Wallerstein has scolded me for agreeing with these modern physicians who not only accept the literal interpretation of the Bible but also interpose their own health beliefs. Well, in 1970, Dr. S. I. McMillan wrote, "Medical researchers agree that freedom from diseases results from circumcision, which God ordered Abraham to institute 4,000 years ago. I grant him that God may have had other reasons for the health of his people in mind when he instituted circumcision, but the fact remains that the ancient Hebrews, whether they knew it or not, gained health benefits from following God's command, just as washing and separation after touching the dead were practiced solely because this was a command of God. So the Hebrews followed God's command of circumcision. It has health benefits, but that's not the purpose of it. And it prevents disease, but that's not the purpose of it. And this is true of all of God's commandments if we obey them. Even if we don't know the specific scientific reason for the command, we will reap benefits from it. Now, the inspiration of the biblical account becomes even more obvious when we take a look at the changes that the Jews made in circumcision over the years. During the few centuries preceding the birth of the Messiah, the Greeks attempted to convert Jews to paganism. These converts blistered the remainder of their foreskins. The resulting scar tissue formed an artificial foreskin, thus obliterating the appearance of circumcision. In order to prevent this practice, the ritual circumcision surgeon ripped away all of the remaining foreskin with his sharpened fingernails. This resulting ragged, filthy wound ensured a high rate of infection. And by the 7th century AD, many Jews added a second change to the ritual. In addition to scraping with his fingernails, the ritual surgeon moistened his lips with wine and then placed the infant's penis in his mouth and then sucked the blood from this ragged wound. You know, even the great Jewish physician Maimonides staunchly supported this procedure as a prophylactic measure against inflammation. The mouth is a perfect medium for growing bacteria. However, so this procedure increased the frequency and the severity of the inflammation from infections. Today, in backward Israeli villages, fatal cases of gangrene, tuberculosis, and tetanus still result from this filthy ritual. In order to save one boy, doctors had to amputate the infant's penis. Why don't modern scientists give us some explanation for the empirical origins of these disease-producing rituals? And why don't they note the careful observations that the Jews must have made in order to come up with these deadly practices? Well, the answer, I think, is pretty simple. Like almost all health rituals of primitive people, these rituals are based on whimsical superstition, not on scientific observation or on the commands of God, so they inevitably have serious and deleterious effects. Now, let's go back here for a moment. Do you remember the story that we were looking at last time? Of all of the practices being performed by these doctors from 1860 through 1970, we could say the same thing. These aren't scientific practices. This is just nonsense. You know, the Bible's got more science in it than all of medical practice combined. The creator of the universe comes along and says, okay, we're going to give you circumcision. I'm going to write a contract with you, and here's the purpose behind it. As a side benefit, we can see, hindsight being 20/20, that there are health benefits that come from it. God never instructed you to use sharpened fingernails and drag out or cut off or make a ragged. I mean, that ought to be just real darn painful now, shouldn't it? Especially when a kid's 5, 6, 8, 10 years old or 15 or whatever. And then we're gonna put our mouth on this penis and we're going to suck this blood out. Doesn't your mouth have a lot of bacteria and dirty bugs in it? Oh, well. Well, God stated the circumcision was to be done with flint knives in Joshua 5, verse 2. Now, God simply commanded that the foreskin be cut off with these knives. This concept of scraping with sharpened fingernails or sucking with your filthy mouth is an addition that some man came up with. This didn't come from God. Now, the use of this particular knife is also interesting because in sharpening a flint knife, you chip away at the stone until one has a sharp edge, exposing new uncontaminated stone. Thus, a newly sharpened flint knife is practically sterile. Isn't it interesting that Moses did not specify one of the common Egyptian ointments containing animal dung in order to speed up the healing? Now, a circumcision symbolized God's old covenant with the children of Abraham. So circumcision symbolizes God's new covenant with the believers in Jesus. The circumcision of the new covenant, however, cannot be performed with a flint knife. As Paul said, in him Christ you are also circumcised in the putting off of the sinful nature, not with a circumcision done by the hands of men, but by the circumcision done by Christ, put to death. Therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil, desires, and greed, which is idolatry, now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these, anger, rage, malice, slander, filthy language, and do not lie with each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices. It comes from Colossians 2:11. Now, that kind of sounds like circumcision's been abolished, doesn't it? And in fact, in the New Testament, you're going to find that there are, let's see if I remember this, 94 statements, 94 scriptures that appear to abrogate, annul, or rescind some law of the Old Testament. And you'll find 143, I believe it is, where it corroborates, builds up, and proves that the Old Testament and the Old Testament laws are still in full force and effect. And people will jump on these statements made off point and out of context. This occurs in law quite often. You'll find a lawyer coming into court citing a case. Why don't you go read the case? It probably supports your position if you go read it. All right, now we'll talk about the New Testament and the Old Testament. This doctor here, he probably has his religious ideas and views, and I don't want to complicate our story so far. What we're trying to determine here is circumcision, does it have a medical benefit? Well, a study finds that circumcision may protect men from HIV. This is Channel News, January 31st, 2000. Let's read this one quickly. I got about 2 minutes left, 3 minutes. Circumcision may somehow protect men from sexual transmission of AIDS virus, researchers said on Sunday, but they admitted that they do not have a clue as to why. Now, a study in Uganda aimed at examining how couples infect one another found two things seemed to protect people, one being old and two being circumcised. Acquisition of HIV did not occur in any of the circumcised men. Dr. Thomas Quinn of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, who led the study, told the Seventh Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections, a meeting of AIDS researchers. Age, independent of viral load, appeared to have a protective effect, Quinn added. The highest transmission rate was in people 15 to 29 years old who were uncircumcised. Quinn's team, working with 15,000 people in the Rakai district of Uganda, also found that people did not pass on the virus to their partners if they had a naturally low level of HIV in the blood, in this case 1,500 copies according to standard measures. He found that the more viruses people had in their blood, the more likely they were to pass it on. There were no differences in women infecting men or men infecting women. Quinn said that his team was one of the first to actually go out and test the idea where HIV is raging the worst. More than 23 million people in sub-Saharan Africa are infected with HIV. And the findings might suggest ways of stemming the epidemic. Telling people to abstain from sex or use condoms has not worked, and the drugs that keep the virus at bay in some patients in rich countries are not available in these poor countries hardest hit by the epidemic. But the study suggests that using drugs to keep the virus at lower levels or a vaccine that might do the same without quite curing a patient might help. Quinn said that he was at a loss to explain why circumcision might affect a man's risk of being infected by a woman. All right, I'm about out of time, so we'll break off right here. We'll take it up right here on HIV/AIDS and what researchers have discovered about circumcision protecting you from AIDS. Again, not necessarily God's intention, but maybe it just worked out that way. A little extra health benefit. All right, let's see where I'm at here. The signal is about here, so we'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here next time, God willing. Same time, same station. So until then, goodbye, friends.